From 90.7 WFAE, this is Black Charlatans, a candid conversation on race. I'm Mary C. Curtis. The world witnessed the slow, excruciating death of George Floyd, an African-American man, as a white policeman held his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes. We were left shaken. Protests filled the streets around the world, including here in Charlotte, as people of all races and ages shouted, wept, demanded justice. For some, it was a shock. For African Americans, it was about much more than George Floyd. It was the anger, the exhaustion, at witnessing once again black pain, black suffering, black death. The video was proof, yes, but why was it needed when we had been speaking about our experiences for so long? Why are people of color not believed? Now, many are craving a conversation. We start that conversation this hour. I'm joined by fellow Charlatans of color to share some stories of our reality, navigating a not always hospitable and sometimes hostile and dangerous world. We invite you to listen and consider. I'm Mary C. Curtis, a journalist and speaker on the intersection of politics, culture, and race. I am a columnist at CQ Roll Call out of Washington, D.C., and a contributor to WFAE, WCCB-TV, and a variety of national outlets, and a senior facilitator with the Op-Ed Project. I'm also an African-American woman, married, and the mother of a son with whom I've had to have the talk about how to deal with law enforcement. I live in Charlotte's Myers Park, where I could not have legally lived until 1968, the passage of the Fair Housing Act. Joining me today are Tracy Benson, Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership at UNC Charlotte, and author of Unconscious Bias in Schools, A Developmental Approach to Exploring Race and Racism. Justin Perry, owner and therapist at Perry Counseling, Healing, and Recovery. He is a partner with the group Charlotte for Black Futures. Tanya Jameson, political consultant, former Charlotte Observer reporter, where she was my colleague. And Leandra Garrett, native Charlatan and longtime community advocate. She works with the groups Block Love Charlotte and United Neighborhoods of Charlotte to build community and feed our homeless neighbors. Welcome all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for joining in this conversation. So I want to just start with dealing with the reality of where our hearts and heads are in this very moment, where we're dealing with our lives and our work and our families, but also with the reality of being African Americans in America and in Charlotte at this very moment. Justin, do you have some thoughts?
You know, in a way, it's not that what's happening or what I think has sparked a lot of this interest is new. I think it's that the awareness or the attention from folks who aren't black is new. We're used to this idea. I'll say this. I'm used to the fact that we went from running with Maude to skipping over Breonna Taylor into George Floyd as these things that kind of just keep happening and feeling like you can't catch a breath from one traumatic event to the next. For me, what's different now is seeing other people all of a sudden have an interest and you know, and be frank, some of it is, especially when you talk from the business standpoint, is there's this reactive energy of, I don't want to lose my money. And now all of the things that we've often fought for, that we've always been kind of talked out of being legitimate, now are legitimate because folks are kind of getting hit in the bottom line. And so it's one of those things that's partially affirming. It's partially affirming because I don't have to be the only voice, but at the same time, what I'm always still leery of is, where's the distraction to get us away from this energy, to get us back to quote unquote normal, so that we can get back to vilifying us as black folks.
Hmm. Tracy, I know that you talk with a lot of audiences, white audiences, that may not have been open to the message. Is that changing, or do you think that will change?
I mean, I'd like to piggyback on what Justin said, that right now we're seeing a different sense of what is outwardly right. And it's a culture of not being seen as racist, you know, a virtue signaling. You know, we have messages that come out from American Airlines, from Nike, from Airbnb. You know, we get inundated with these emails about, we stand with you and we're anti-racist and things of that sort. And so I think there's a sort of an interest convergence in in terms of our liberation and white, historically white organizations and companies being seen as non-racist, but for a bottom line. You know, we want to be together with the against the racism out there. But when it comes to the close personal intermediate within these companies' circle of influence in terms of like their governing board, who they hire, their actual actions prior to George Floyd, you know, we haven't seen purposeful action. We haven't seen the pivot from we now recognize the racism out there, and then now we're going to deal with the racism in here. You know, we're going to deal with the racism in front of us in order to affect that. And so when I talk with a lot of white school leaders and education-based organizations, that we have to get past this trope of virtue signaling, past this trope of just being seen as anti-racist, to actually doing the hard work of examining where racism shows up in their organizations, within their schools, within themselves, and then changing it in their close personal and media.
Mm. Leandra, have you seen any differences in how people see the folks you work with and how they view your life as well?
I don't think there's been a difference, because I deal with a lot of people that are oppressed and poor people. And so I think that in this fight, they're the ones fighting the fight. They're the ones that's always been fighting the fight. The police brutality doesn't change. What the police have done to them hasn't changed. It continues. I just think that us grasping really what's going on and helping them understand that these are things that's been going on in the world, they just haven't been a part of it because of their situations. And so they don't have a way to see or hear it. And so we're bringing that to them. And now they were able to see it firsthand when they had the group that went down and fed the homeless. And they were actually terrified because police came in riot gear and bikes. And so they were in fear for their lives because they didn't know when, you know, something bad may happen to them. So I just think that that would be no for them.
How about you, Tanya?
What I see when I see this, what's happened recently, is the idea that, as Leandra said, you know, in the past, everything was the protests, the speeches, everything was happening uptown. It was all in the uptown area. But this time, we actually have people in South Charlotte. I do a lot of my work in South Charlotte, who are welcoming and open to the idea of making a statement in the South Charlotte area, having marches in the South Charlotte area. And so one of the things I think is incumbent upon us is to figure out a way to sort of meet people where they are as well. You know, what Tracy and Justin said about the business community is important, but how do we get into the hearts and minds of everyday people, moms and dads who are just working and they don't feel like they're part of the structure of racism, but how can we figure out a way to meet them where they are, that they can get involved and feel like they can contribute and help chip away at this, because this is something that we've got to chip away at. We're not going to just do it with some easy resolutions or some new policies or pulling down statues. How do we really change the hearts and the minds of the people living in their neighborhoods and their gated communities who don't necessarily have, you know, everyday interactions with African Americans who don't look like them or who aren't on the same socioeconomic scale as they are? The acceptable tokenism, as Justin was saying.
Well, you raise a good question there. How, it's a moment, people have marched, people have volunteered, people have said, well, you know, I'm doing my part. So how does it become a movement and it's not something that's in the rearview mirror after the Black Lives Matter signs are taken down from their business or from their homes?
I think it's a part of the conversation what Tracy was saying and Justin, it's in the boardroom, in the decisions, actually going out and interacting and figuring out ways to address this, whether or not that is bringing somebody into your neighborhood association, electing somebody maybe that's African-American to be the head of your homeowners association, doing other things in the community that get you out of your comfort zone. It's time for us to stop being so comfortable. We're very comfortable. We are comfortable sitting on the sidelines. We're comfortable having a march in South Charlotte, but then how do we take it to that next level? Are we willing to do more than just the symbolic gestures? I think we all need to get more comfortable being uncomfortable with this conversation and challenging ourselves.
I think kind of coming off that, I think it's got to be effective bridging, even from those of us that are fighting for the same thing, right? I think it can't be a division between folks who are in the boardrooms and folks who are on the streets. like that, and that's one of the things that we don't often talk about that happens in this. There's like this idea, because I get asked these questions all the time. Well, how do you feel about the rioters, the looters, or whatever else? And I'm like, one, you're not going to distract me. You know, our country is built on rioting and looting. Let's be honest. All right. Like without rioting and looting, I don't really know what progress Westerners have made on this land. You know, we just don't call it that. We call it settling. Right. Mm-hmm. We call it market forces. But in the end, what we're talking about is stripping resources from folks. We're talking about using violence to uphold power, all these kinds of things. And so for me, I don't get sucked into that. What I simply say is my job is to recognize that all behavior is an expression of need. And so if we got folks who've been cooped up in the midst of this pandemic, who are now motivated to march through town night after night, night after night, night after night, not paid, right? They're not paid for this. And what I also know is, again, the energy they get is very different from police than the energy that folks who stormed the state capitals with guns got, right? Like, I'm not here to demonize them. I'm saying they're fighting for the same things I'm fighting for. And my job is to amplify their voices, to amplify their pain, to help humanize it. Because again, and so as working as a therapist, one of the things I get to see is I get to see this stuff from all angles. Mm-hmm. I get to see trauma from all angles. And I've worked not only with folks inside the city, poor, black, brown. I've worked in Stanley County with poor, white, rural. I've worked with plenty of folks from South Charlotte and everything else. And so the reality is I know the secrets that nobody talks about, right? And so I know that when folks say things like, well, we got to have the police to control this and control that, and we got to control the crime. Well, what I know is somebody who treats plenty of adolescents and adults from South Charlotte and the northern suburbs, like, well, the majority of crime is drug based. And my longest assessments around drugs are on your kids and your family, right? But they're coming to me to get treatment versus going to jail and to prison. And so I'm looking to shift the paradigm. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I try to work to serve as a bridge and to help humanize folks who, again, have long been dehumanized. And so I think it's really incumbent upon us to not allow us to be divided as the people who are worthy mm-hmm. of support. You know, again, the worthy victim of police brutality versus the one who deserved it. In the end, there's no worthy or unworthy. In the end, if I'm black, I fit the description. And that doesn't matter, regardless, to Leandra's point, of whether I'm homeless, whether I got graduate degrees. In the end, when I get pulled over, none of that stuff matters. And so for me, it's just as important to make sure that I'm advocating for the folks who are houseless, as she says, as I am for folks who are living as the lone black representative in a predominantly white suburb.
No, you make some great points there. And I think we can all relate to the people we have dealt with who are white, and we know whose kids or who have had past drug busts or other situations and have not had that count on the record. And as someone who grew up in a community, West Baltimore, that was underprotected and over-policed, and seeing situations I have slipped out of just because it was just luck, and other people have been caught in the system, and for situations that somebody else would be sent to the principal's office for, something like that, it's very different. I see you shaking your head, both Leandra and Tracy.
I think one of the biggest things that would solve a lot of the problems that we see is bringing those people to the table that are proximate to the problem. I don't get to tell a person who's houseless on the street that it's not okay to go in the store and steal a loaf of bread and a pack of meat because they haven't eaten in 2 days if I've never been in that situation. I don't get to tell the local drug dealer on the corner that it's not okay to sell crack in this community when he doesn't have a means of taking care of his family because of his past or because of who he once was, and now he wants to do something different. But there's no alternatives here. When it comes to racism, when it comes to what we're seeing now, the difference is the people that sit at the table are not the ones that are affected by the problems that they're trying to solve. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you have no answers. Therefore, you have no outcomes, and you're going to continue to see what you see all across the country, because we know that the police departments all across the country, just like the United States military, reign from white supremacy. And so until those systems start to be broken down, and until the people that are proximate to the problem are brought to the table, we can't even begin to solve the issues and talk about major changes, because we know the justice system is set up the way that they intended for it to work. It's working just fine. It's not broken. Even with me, I look at my situation and I tell people all of the things that people talk about dismantling in this country, welfare, affordable housing, public housing, education, mental health. All of those things are things that I personally have been a part of. And so when I speak and I talk about it, I tell people that I'm a part of the very system that people are trying to dismantle. And so I've had all of the incidents with the police, whether it was with my children in school or me personally. But until those conversations change and we change the false narratives that we're giving out about what it really is and have these deep, uncomfortable situations. And sometimes we're going to have to come away from the table. We're going to have to go to the community, because guess what? These people in the community don't always have a way to the table. And it should not be that all these conversations have to be in Myers Park, or, oh, they have to be inside of the church. There's plenty of parks. There's plenty of space. And I think when we start setting those standards from the standards that we were used to, we're going to keep seeing what we're seeing.
Tracy, you want to get in on this?
Yeah, there's so much that's just been said, and I'm really enjoying this conversation because it's cathartic in a way. What I heard in terms of, you know, allegiances across folks who are on the front line, who are in the streets, who are the most proximate to the police violence, and those who are in these boardrooms, there are some of us, folks of color, who are in these boardroom spaces. And in terms of my story, I come from what they call inner city Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I don't know if folks know where that is, but it was the most segregated city in the U.S. for over 20 years. Now it's number two. But basically, you know, folks know where Black folks are. And my mother and family, we've always lived where Black people are. The biggest danger to us wasn't each other. It was the police officers. You know, from the time I got my driver's license until I left Milwaukee, I got stopped over 30 times. I got frisks. I got guns pulled on me. But being in there, I thought this was normal. I thought police were that violent and that and targeted until I left Wisconsin. I'm like, oh, my goodness, Milwaukee's a very violent place from law enforcement. I didn't understand that that's not normal everywhere. But at the same time, you know, I was out protesting and when I was at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I was protesting when I had the opportunity to protest against these things a long time ago. You know, when the stuff was happening with Rodney King back in the day. So this is not something that is new. And now that I've gotten to a position where, you know, I've been a principal, you know, I went to Harvard and got a doctorate. I'm now in these spaces at University of Wisconsin, I mean, University of North Carolina at Charlotte. I think a lot of us have this mentality of risk management. Are we willing to still be on the front lines within these organizations? Are we too concerned about our safety? Mm-hmm. Can you say what you need to say when you see racism showing up and who we admit to colleges, the courses we offer, the way that Black faculty are treated at these universities? Are you willing to risk it just as much as you risked it when you were on these front lines marching in these streets? Or are you having a sense of risk management? Not all of us can do that, and I don't put blame. But what I do say is that those of us who are in these rooms where we are pushing for change in our own way, we can't demonize those who are on the front lines in the street and protesting in ways that we can't anymore in our safe space.
I wanted to ask, too, why you think that this was different? Why was the George Floyd and these protests different? We've had videos before. We had a North Charleston video where we saw Walter Scott be shot by Officer Michael Slager in the back. And you didn't have this. What was it about this moment? Was it that people were paying more attention because of COVID? Was it because of the look on the officer's face as he nonchalantly had his knee on the neck? Why do you think now we're having these conversations and people are a little bit more willing to listen?
I think part of it is because when we talk about normalization, we're almost at the point where we're used to seeing Black men unarmed being shot by police. Like, it happens so often now, and it's just like a movie almost. But to watch an officer basically sit there and kill a man with his knee on his neck for 8 minutes, that's an excruciating amount of time to watch someone suffer and die compared to somebody being shot, which you see regularly on the news when you have, you know, police encounters with unarmed black men that end fatally. Regularly, just in regular TV shows, we see, you know, black people being shot all the time. And so to watch something like this, though, it just takes your breath away to see something like this happen. So I think that's one of the reasons that this was just so horrific to see. It wasn't quick.
Mm, that's kind of sad. Yeah, we've gotten to the point where being shot won't shock you.
Yeah, I think there's this. I've been thinking about this question for a long time. Like, what is it about George Floyd and this situation that's made it blow up like a powder keg? You know, I was in Ferguson. We did a case study on Ferguson in the school district in the shooting of Michael Brown. And that was an incident where we had Black Lives Matter was born. We had marches in the streets. We had national demonstrations, but not to this level. You know, we have this pressure cooker of a president who openly supports white supremacy. We have a national pandemic that has disproportionately affected people of color, but also poor white folks. And then we have large swaths of joblessness where people are constantly frustrated and it's very unpredictable. And we've been seeing these televised killings of black folks for quite some time. But what I did notice that was different about this situation is that the media wasn't able to get ahead and destroy George Floyd before we got behind him. Every other case, from Tamir Rice to Michael Brown to Philando Castile to whoever, there was always this negative narrative that came out simultaneous as their killing was televised. But in this case, what I found very interesting is that the narrative was controlled, I feel, by the people. Mm-hmm. And that you had such a groundswell of frustration with our current administration and our current president that pulled back the Band-Aid over the gaping wound of racism in our country. Like, this was always there. You know, folks who are surprised about who we are right now, this open expression of racism, this is always who we've been. We just had someone to pull back the cover, and now we can see it. And now America's at a reckoning on who we're going to be defined as. I think globally we're seen as a country that's in peril. It's in racial strife. And so I think folks have to choose a street. And these confluence of events around George Floyd at least allows people, especially white people, to openly espouse their commitment to anti-racism. Because that's important, because we've been so much defined by racism, our country, from our president and from his supporters, that I think a lot of folks are using this as an opportunity to say, no, we're not with it. We're not about this. And we're going to get on and we're going to openly espouse that in the streets by marching and on TVs and in statements as a direct affront to what we've been characterized as.
Justin,
you know, I think in a way, like I said, I think starting with the Ahmaud Arbery situation, I think one of the things that happened there was you had a couple of things there. Like, you had the racist Southern boogeyman that everybody likes to kind of hide behind. Right. And so there was already some energy that folks were like, oh, well, he was just out running. And so, again, I mean, a lot of white folks jog through neighborhoods and everything else. And so there was already like this connection there. And so but folks, again, hadn't even had a chance to fully go through that campaign. And here you have this nesting that happens. So I think there's a couple things at play. I think the pandemic, the stay at home orders and everything else absolutely impacted. I think the absence of live sports, the inability to be in bars and restaurants, all of the distractions that we normally have were not there as much, right? And so it actually really forced folks to see it. And then to take it through that point, 8 minutes and 46 seconds, this white man kneeling on this black man's neck with no regard, with this man crying out for his mama, with several other officers around not intervening, it was like the perfect metaphor of America and racism versus anti-racism right there. Because again, the concept of being not racist is simply saying I wasn't one of the ones with my knee on his neck. And what we could push to say is no, anti-racism is getting him off of the man's neck. And so folks, to have to actually watch this play out, and again, the visual was the metaphor.
Yeah.
The metaphor, again, there's actually a Malcolm X quote, you know, about it not being a chip on my shoulder. That's your knee on my neck, right? And so this is like right there for folks to see. And to that point, then Tracy's point, all of the people who tried to play it neutral before, both sides and everything else, is like, I actually have to pick a side right now. Yeah. I can't lie to myself. I can't say that he was reaching for something. This was just slow and dragged out. And again, a man crying out for his mama, there's nothing more primal, right,
Yeah. We need to take a short break. My guests are Tracy Benson, Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership at UNC Charlotte, Justin Perry, owner and therapist at Perry Counseling, Healing and Recovery, Tanya Jameson, political consultant and former Charlotte Observer reporter, and Leandra Garrett, a longtime community advocate. I'm Mary C. Curtis. Black Charlatans, a candid conversation on race, will continue in just a moment. This is Black Charlatans, a candid conversation on race, a special WFAE presentation. I'm Mary C. Curtis. I'm talking this hour with fellow Charlatans of color about race, racism, and the challenges we face being black in America. The country is still reeling from the death of George Floyd and the protests that followed. It's forced a conversation on the table about inequities that African Americans have been experiencing long before this moment. My guests are Tracy Benson, Assistant Professor at Educational Leadership at UNC Charlotte, Justin Perry, owner and therapist at Perry Counseling, Healing and Recovery, Tanya Jameson, political consultant and former Charlotte Observer reporter, and Leandra Garrett, a longtime community advocate. Some of you have shared your experiences with law enforcement and with a system that is racist. So I think that some of our listeners probably don't even hear that. So if others who are on the panel would want to share things that have happened to them, here in Charlotte, my son was stopped and profiled in Myers Park because it is a majority white area. So what are you doing there? So you're supposed to work hard enough to be able to live someplace. But then if you're there, they're going to question why you're there. I have been stopped when my car was new and it was red and I was in my beat up gym clothes for going through a stop sign, and I didn't go through a stop sign. I only ended up getting a warning. But before I knew it, three police officers were coming toward me with their hands on their weapons. Would anybody else like to share some things that maybe, as Tracy's already shared, he was stopped time and again?
I can talk about
Tanya?
My experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was in 2017, I think it was now, I was picking up a car in Knoxville that I bought from a white lady. And I was putting on the license plate, and her son-in-law lived across the street, and he thought I was trying to steal the car. And so he basically approached me and had his gun pulled and trained on me. And he was calling 911 at the same time that he was holding me at gunpoint. And, you know, I sat there, or I stood there thinking, when I realized, when he said that he was an off-duty police officer, that, you know, they shoot to kill. And Philando Castile had just occurred maybe like 2 weeks or so before. And I knew at that distance from where he wasn't going to miss. And so I was just focused on making sure that I didn't do anything that would startle him or make him think that I was being aggressive. And actually, when I was, after the situation ended and I was on my way home, I you know, posted about it. And, you know, because at first I thought, like, you know, of course this is going to happen to me. You know, I'm a black person picking up a car. Of course somebody's going to think I'm stealing a car. And I posted about it. And then I realized the potential to show people how easily these situations get out of hand with encounters with the police department. I wanted people to understand that somebody that you know, that shops at Whole Foods like you do, somebody that travels in the same circles that you do, this can happen to them too. And they can easily become a hashtag, and police will write the whatever narrative that they want to write. And so, but, you know, we talk about normalizing. It just, you know, when it happened, it's like, yeah, of course, you know, that's just what happens to black people because you're on a side of town that you're not supposed to be on. And you begin to kind of blame yourself for putting yourself in that situation. I know for like weeks afterwards, I was like, you know, I should have called this person, or I should have let somebody know I was there. And so you just get into this kind of blaming yourself for basically being the victim.
Yeah. Justin, did you want to? I know you have two little kids, and so you want them to be carefree. At the same time, you want them to be realistic and know perhaps maybe they can't get away with doing some of the things their white schoolmates and playmates do.
No, absolutely. I mean, and essentially, because like the bar, I think the bar we have is so low, right? Because, I mean, and that's the thing is, like, for me, I look at myself, like, I've been profiled plenty of times, you know, whether it's pulled over for things that I know I couldn't have done, like, supposedly didn't have my headlights on a road where you can't, there's no way I could have seen, you know, and even just standing in my own driveway at one point at the end of walking my dog, having an officer just sitting right at the corner and just kind of staring at me. and me having that realization, that quick kind of thing, he thinks I'm up to something. And again, as somebody who's been 6'2", almost 200 pounds since I was headed into ninth grade, I've learned how to try to be less threatening, right? And trying to look and smile and wave my hand and borderline do a jig almost, right?
Yeah.
And basically just kind of person just kind of glare and then just turn and just pull off and everything else, be irritated and walk into the house and then walk in and see on TV the story of Michael Brown that just had happened and everything else, and just seeing how small, like, because I wanted to be like, look, I paid for this house, my name is on the mortgage and everything else, but if I come with any kind of energy, you know, because we don't even have to come with energy, but if I come with any kind of energy, that's all a threat is needed to justify, and somebody's going to pull up whatever happened in my background to justify this stuff. And so it's interesting, two things, like, so just thinking about, you know, obviously we talk about having to talk. I had to talk as a kid, but then even my principal at West Charlotte got in trouble because as a sophomore, he had an all-black male assembly, and there were two prominent things that happened in there. There was our coach's brother was a entrepreneur and a multimillionaire that told us about wealth building. And then the other part was a black police officer came in and told us how to survive if we got pulled over. And again, this is 1996, right? So again, it's in the social media creation or whatever else, my grandparents, all of us knew these kinds of things. And he's given all of us a story about how to hold our hands, how to talk, the stuff that, again, most of us had already heard. Then fast forward, you know, 15 years later, I'm working in an affluent white church working with their youth again, and I'm the only black person in the room, and an officer comes in and talks to the kids about what to do in the event that they've been drinking or smoking and are intoxicated. This is what you do so you don't get in trouble, and we'll just take you home to your parents. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, when I was their age, I got a conversation about how to survive in the event that I was pulled over, whether I broke the law or not. They're getting a conversation about after you break the law, which we know you're going to do, this is what you do to not get in trouble, right? And so that's it in a nutshell. And so now I have two kids. You know, my son came home one time and he was 4 or 5, I think. And one of the parting gifts was like a toy. I don't even know if it was a water gun or whatever else. And we hadn't given him anything like that yet. And I'm like, yeah. You know, I was heated.
Tamir Rice, yeah.
You know, and I'm knowing, and I know the families. I know they didn't have any kind of ill intent, but again, they're oblivious. And so for him, like even little water guns and Nerf guns, we make sure they all are just as bright colored as possible. We tell him he can only play in the backyard, which has a fence in it and everything else. He cannot take it in the front yard. If he goes to one of his friends' houses, and they want to play in the front yard, that you can't do that. You got to do this in the back. Now, again, he sits. You know, we're letting him know about Tamir Rice and letting him know these realities, which, again, are hard for a kid to hear. But at the same time, I'd rather him hear that from us than have the consequences of being oblivious.
Yeah. You don't want him to be paranoid, but you don't want him to be dead. And exactly. And when I say that, that sounds stark. But, you know, there comes a point when your kid goes from being the cute little kid to something else. And black parents know that. Leandra, you've talked about dealing with racism at different points in your life. Obviously, it hasn't stopped you from achievement, but it's just the exhaustion of trying to push through that. Could you talk a little bit about some of the things that you've had to overcome?
So I haven't always been on this side of the tracks, and I share that with people all the time. I've lived a totally different life, and so my encounter with the police have been some of what we see. I just happen to live through them. Mm-hmm. I've been incarcerated before. My first incarceration, I remember being 21 years old. I had came back to visit Charlotte because I was living in Georgia at the time, and I had dreadlocks, and I drove a 92 Honda Accord. And it just so happened that I was in a Lexus Jeep going through the neighborhood, Southside Homes. You know, I stopped at a stop sign. I seen a police officer, and the officer got behind me. And next thing I know, it was about 20 cars of police behind me. And so I made it up to the rent office because I knew that someone was there. But by me having locks and these officers seeing me from the back, they automatically assumed that I was a black male. So they jumped out their cars, all of them guns pointed, and I had my hands up. And I had a officer on the driver's side snatched my door open, and he went to snatch me out of the car by my seatbelt with his gun in his hand, and he told me, if you move, I'll blow your MF brains out. The lady officer that was coming around, she was like, guns up, this is a lady. And so he put his gun up and he said, oh, well, just unlock your seatbelt. And so I'm asking them, what is this for? And he said, the car that you're in is stolen. And I said, stolen? I said, my friend got, you know, I'm driving my friend guy's car. And so come to find out, it was a stolen car. I had the keys to it. But they took me downtown, and I sat downtown, and I had two detectives interrogate me for over 3 hours. Not to even talk about the male officer that frisked me. You know, he stuck his hand down my shirt. Mm. You know, he put his hands up between my legs. So just that alone was one of my first encounters with CMPD that rubbed me the wrong way. And then, you know, the lifestyle that I live, when I stayed on Bates Ford Road, I had a lot of encounters with CMPD that were just not pleasant. And then on to having children, and my daughter she's bipolar, and she's also a manic depressor. And so I got a phone call from her school when she was in like the 11th grade because she wanted to kill herself. And I think one of the most disheartening things was for them to tell me that if I did not take her to mental health by 12 o'clock that night, that they would issue a warrant for my arrest and that they would lock me up. So I've been beat up by the police, head slammed on the car. I've been thrown on the hot pavement, you know, knee in my back. And so these same things are things that I can relate to because, like I said, I have not always been who I am. And so that's why I tell people all the time, when I'm invited into that room, I'm going to speak and stand in my truth. And if it's anybody in that room who doesn't like it, I'm sorry, but I would not sugarcoat for the white people that's sitting in that room, or for the black elite that have forgotten that you had an opportunity that I didn't, because I chose to be a teen mom. So I've had a lot of encounters. And I also think about having a 13-year-old with autism that only understands one-step directions, and he carries something in his hands all the time. And so I always think about him getting older, and he walks and he runs. Having that thing in his hand and somebody not knowing what it is and call the police, and they give those commands of, drop what's in your hands, put your hands up, you know, stay faced away from me, back up with your hands towards me. Well, guess what? He didn't understand past the first of what you said. So now he can be killed because he didn't understand anything past that. So it's like saying, does he wear a shirt every day, you know, as he gets older that says, I have autism and I don't understand? Yeah. You know, these are the things that I have to think about
every day.
You know,
I would be interested, you know, so many of my white acquaintances, now they come and they want to say, you know, what book should I read? What should I do? They want some kind of an answer. And I always say, well, I'm not like the black sage of the world to come and educate you. There's ways to I'm sure your colleagues are saying the same thing. Like, what do I need to do? What do you say to them? What are those conversations like?
I'm actually curious everybody's thought just in general, because I feel like that oftentimes, Mary. Like, I am not, you know, I'm so tired of educating you about racism that we talk about all the time. But then it's like, but if I don't take the time to do it, you know, who else is going to do it? Where are they going to get this information that they seem to now seek? But it is frustrating that it feels like you're always having these conversations. I mean, I've seen Justin on a gajillion panels and discussions talking about this. And it's just like, how much more do we need to talk for you to believe us when we say, this is what's happening, this is what's destroying our community, this is what's preventing us from getting ahead? Like when Leandra talks about having her encounters with the police department, and then once you have a criminal record, and then having, you know, the ability to then therefore go and get a job. And so, you know, I'm ready to go beyond talking about it and looking at what is it that you are willing to do. If you own a small business, are you willing to hire somebody who has a criminal history? Are you willing to take that part off of your application for mm-hmm. a job in the first place and give somebody a shot just based on, you know, that the interview process, what they have on their resume and the skills that they bring?
Yeah. I mean, I know sometimes you said, you know, people get paid for this. It's called consulting. everybody wants you to be their black friend, you know?
Go on. That's actually what I do say to them.
Yeah, Justin.
I say point blank, there's no more free lunches, you know? And in the end, like, I think that there's a collective on that. And so for me, it is not only, it's not just about my pace, but if I'm going to have a Leandra come in here and share her authentic story and put all of that out here on the table, that's not volunteer work, folks. Mm-hmm. Right. This is not a free movie for you to see. You need to pay for the expertise. But then to Tanya's point, what is your sphere of influence?
Yeah.
You know, that's what I always say is, again, everybody has a sphere of influence. So if you've got this neighborhood that was built on white supremacy, well, you actually need to be the people who are advocating for affordable housing in that neighborhood. Right. So, again, I can't have a Ballantyne not be able to be a part of the 30% AMI. And then you've got all your kids in childcare with black female teachers who are making 30% AMI. Mm-hmm. Right. So again, it's looking at what is it in my sphere of influence, whether it's the schools in the neighborhoods, whether it is paying attention to why are my kids getting to go to treatment for their drug use, but this kid over here is getting a record. My kid uses more drugs than they do. Right. And so, again, all of these things, we all have a sphere of influence. And so to me, it's like, yeah, you can do your reading on your own, or if you're going to want the education, we can do that, but you're going to have to pay for it. But then you're going to actually have to then do something different. What does your board look like? Do you have people who are near the problem, approximate, as Leandra said, on your board? Because they're actually going to give you insight into the population you, quote unquote, are trying to serve. So, again, all of us have ways that when I talk to white folks, again, it's saying, look, you're not responsible for everything that happened before you, but you are responsible once you have new knowledge to do something different going forward. And if you don't understand, you're simply doubling down on all of those quote unquote evil deeds and evil systems that came before you.
Leandra and Tracy, I'd like to ask you, what do you hope comes out of this moment where, at least for this moment, everyone is paying attention? You certainly see, Leandra, a lot of problems on the ground. And as you said, the narrative still hasn't changed for a lot of the people you work with. So what would you like to see come out of this time?
One of my biggest things is, again, changing the narrative, changing mindsets, and continuing to have the uncomfortable situations. The other thing is keep fighting for what we as individuals believe in, what we know is right, whether it's in our workplace, whether it's around our friends, no matter where it is, like, you have to always be willing to stand in that truth, and you have to be the change that you want to see, you know? And so, like Justin said, I had to learn my self-worth when it came to this whole world of giving, because that's what I do all the time. You know, people will take, and it's like you're giving them the blueprint for free, and they take that blueprint and try to make it their own. And so I think that as we're given these blueprints, we have to say, hey, this blueprint isn't free, because if you went and paid an architect, it's not free. So you're going to have to pay me now because I'm giving you this blueprint. And so I think that when people have to spend their money on something that's very important and that they need to see the change and to understand, they respect it a lot more. And then they want to have that deep dive. The other thing is, the one thing that you can give me that's most valuable is your time. So if you give me nothing else, I want you to come from Myers Park. I want you to come from wherever you are in your silo. Come to my neighborhood. Come to, you know, the camps. Come to where I am. And you will see why I continue to do the work that I do. You will see why I want to make the changes, changing the environment and the narratives. Because, again, if we do not, we're going to keep pointing those fingers back and forth, and we're going to keep being on this merry-go-round. So I think just keeping up what we're doing. We've seen changes just in these marches. I think if we keep these marches up and we keep having these real conversations that's open, it'll change a lot of the narratives for Black and brown oppressed and poor people that we see here in Charlotte and throughout the country.
Yeah. How about you, Tracy?
Well, I see that. I mean, back to your other question about when my folks ask, you know, their Black friend or colleague, you know, what should I do?
Yeah.
You know, and at this point, I've responded that, you know, I see on Facebook, you Google how to make homemade bread and and homemade masks. But yeah, you can't Google being anti-racist. You know, it's all over there. W.E.B. Du Bois was writing about this back in 1868. You know, about Black double consciousness. You have James Baldwin, who has a lot of his talks up on YouTube back from, you know, 1960s. You know, so you can Google homemade bread, but you can't Google anti-racism, you know? So why don't you do a little bit of research on that if you're really interested in being an anti-racist, not waiting for someone with brown skin to tell you what to do and take it as the gospel, right? Mm-hmm. You're smart, intelligent people. And so what I hope to come out of this, and what I want to put it into, that's why I write, I speak, I research racism, you know, and so there are a lot of resources I put out there because I know in education, in my lane, the majority of folks who control that space are white.
Mm-hmm.
And so come to my work, give me a call. I'll be your Black friend, you know, for a price, but I'll be there for if you're really interested in putting towards resources toward being an anti-racist.
Mm-hmm.
But what I hope out of this is Janice Helms writes about racial identity development. She writes about Black racial identity development and racial identity development of white people. And what I hope is that people progress in their racial identity development. And so what I see it is that a lot of folks, you know, were subscribed to passive racism. They knew it exists, but it didn't have anything to do with them. It didn't affect them in their close personal immediate, or they saw it, but they said, it's not my responsibility. I think I've seen folks transition from passive racism to white liberal racism. All right, there's gradations of racism. But this white liberal racism is that law enforcement is a problem. It's a singular problem. So I've seen that development from passive to like, all right, now I see a problem out there. I want to do something about that. Now to make another gradation of that, it's like, all right, I see the racism out there. That's now allowing me to understand that there's racism in here and what I'm willing to do about that. So that's where I hope we get to. We transverse from passive racism to white liberal racism, where I think a lot of people are now, to the next step, which is like, all right, there's racism in here that I'm not responsible to deal with.
Yeah. Justin, and then we can go all around.
My hope is that we shift from a baseline of Black Lives Matter into Black Lives are worth investing in. All right. So to me, a tangible thing that I could see is, again, in a city where we talk about economic mobility and an affordable housing crisis, where the two of those things have a combined 4% of the budget less. And then we have a police budget that is 40.4%. I would love for us, as a place that constantly talks about root causes, actually invest in the root causes and invest in the longtime Charlottesians that are overwhelmingly Black, who constantly get stepped on in the progress of folks who we recruit to our city. So I would love for our values and our budgets to reflect what they are in our declarations.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say that Leandra talked about the blueprint and her creating the blueprint. And I want for people, when Leandra and Justin and Tracy create the blueprints and they share them, for people to actually implement them. Because so often in Charlotte, we are really good at having a conversation and saying, oh, I met with Justin or I met with Leandra and she was great. And oh my goodness, Justin speaks so well. But then they don't ever actually do anything with the information that's been imparted. So even if you just do a little bit, even if you take a small bite out of the elephant, that's gonna get us a lot closer to than you just talking about it. And my other last point is, since I am in politics, please, 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 this election is so important. Volunteer for a campaign, volunteer, and then definitely go vote. But if you really want to make the changes that you're talking about, you have to get involved in politics. And politics really is local. So take the time to actually spend some time after the marches are over, volunteer somehow on a local campaign, and make sure you go and vote, because that's really the only way we're going to change is if we have the people in office who are doing the things that we want them to do.
Yeah. Tracy, did you have some final thoughts?
Yeah, I just wanted to put a call out to my fellow educators, and this is something I've been saying for a long time, pre-George Floyd, is that what we know is that everyone who has a professional job in our society goes through our schools. Everyone goes through our schools. The schools have been traditionally a color mute space where we don't talk about race. We don't talk about racism. And what we're doing is we're replicating a system of racially illiterate adults who can't talk about it in a space across race because we don't have the practice in doing it. And we've been taught through our schools that it's taboo. And so when we go back to schools in the fall, our children know, our students know, and they want to talk about it. And as adults, we have to suspend our discomfort and allow and give them space to discuss it so they develop the skills and ability to have these discussions so they aren't as racially illiterate as we are this day as adults. So hopefully in the future, when it comes to discussions of race, when this generation graduates and becomes professionals, that they'll have more racial illiteracy so this conversation can look different across races than it does now.
That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests, Tracy Benson, Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership at UNC Charlotte, Justin Perry, owner and therapist at Perry Counseling, Healing and Recovery, Tanya Jameson, political consultant and former Charlotte Observer reporter, and Leandra Garrett, a longtime community advocate. We want to keep this conversation going. If you have a story you'd like to share or you just want to get in touch, email us at tellus@wfae.org or visit wfae.org. This has been Black Charlatans, A Candid Conversation on Race, a special WFAE presentation. The producer was Aaron Kiever. I'm Mary C. Curtis.